Shayna, my dear.
Christopher.
You know how sometimes we get this little moment before the show begins when it's just the two of us?
Yes, that intimate little moment when it's just us.
I wanted to ask you a question because I think as the Unitarian here...
Unitarian Universalist.
Thank you.
Okay.
As the Unitarian Universalist here, that you might have the expertise to satisfy a curiosity I had. Can you explain?
I live to serve, Chris. I live to serve.
I was just curious about the Laughing Buddha. Do you know anything about the Laughing Buddha and what that laughter signifies?
I do not.
Oh, okay.
Offhand.
Okay. I raised the question because laughter is an important part of our show. And I think laughter has a very deep, there's something very deep about laughter. I don't find it frivolous at all, but rather something essential to not just our human being, but essential to our show. Like it gets at something about our show. So I thought maybe, you know, there was some connection, some wisdom you could share about the Laughing Buddha.
I would be happy to look into that, but I don't, I mean, and I could guess at some things, but I don't know.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Let's, you know, that was just the two of us.
That was just the two of us. And I don't have an answer, but okay.
We'll start the show.
Welcome to What in God's Name. He's Chris Owen.
And she is Shayna Appel.
We are the podcast that is seeking to reclaim the public narrative. What do we mean when we say that, Chris?
Well, we're practicing the discipline of reading culture and society through the lenses of philosophy, moral philosophy, and theology. We're pushing back against the default position that the way we think about and the conceptual frameworks we use to see what's going on in the world are politics and economics, which are reductive. The way, at least, we practice them and think of them
the way they are
reductive of the human being.
So we seek to get beyond those binaries in order to engage a conversation that has as its center focus and purpose human flourishing and actually the flourishing of all beings and of all life, a world effectively that works for everyone with no one and nothing left out.
You know, Shayna, it's not inevitable that democracy endures, and it's not inevitable that religion or spirituality is a benign force on society. In fact, history shows that democracies devolve, and history shows that religion can be a very malignant force. So what you and I are doing, what this project's about, what other people are doing who we seek to join forces with, is to do the work of making spirituality, religion, moral philosophy, make that a benign force, a benignant force, a force for good.
A force for good, yeah, because I don't, yeah. Yeah, yes, I was going to push back against the notion that it has to be either benign or malignant. I'm like, well, wait a minute, how about
yeah, yeah.
Whoa, hey, yeah,
I'm sorry, I wasn't using benign in the sense of just kind of happily there. I meant actively good. Is that what you were?
Yes, active yeah. Good. I was seeking the active good. So we have a spinny wheel that we use at the beginning of the show. It kind of limbers us up. It gets us into, it gets our brains and our mouths loosened up a little bit.
I think the spinny wheel is an anti-totalitarian. I think the spinny wheel is an anti-totalitarian practice.
And if you are new to our show, therein lies the fundamental difference between Chris and myself. The spinny wheel is made of a bicycle wheel tacked to a board with a hose head strapped to it as a pointer because we're swamp Yankees from, you know, New Hampshire, USA. So I think today is my turn, Chris. I'm going to go ahead and give it a spin.
The spinny wheel has landed on our definition of culture, which is habits of mind and patterns of behavior. One of the key ideas for this project that has a podcast is to raise to consciousness the habits of mind and patterns of behavior that we unthinkingly engage in. And I've referred to that already in our show opener. Part of our culture is we are socialized to conceive of our shared common life in the framework of politics and economics. That's one small piece of culture. But it's so our work is to raise to consciousness these things that we simply assume
take for granted.
Thank you. I was looking for
as what is so, you know, I mean, this stuff comes about, you know, it's interesting. I actually preached some on this last weekend and Chris actually showed up to church. And for me, the significance of culture and the way that we're framing it is that these patterns of thought and habits of behavior come about unthinkingly. They're not chosen. They evolve over time. And so like fish who swim in water day in and day out and yet have no construct for water whatsoever, even though it determines so much of their lives, you know, we're swimming in this sea of culture. It is impacting us always, and we can't understand why certain things just keep happening. You know, maybe it's the water we're swimming in, and maybe waking up to that water is some of what we're trying to accomplish with our program.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Moving on. Yes, this is the new sound signal for our new sound signal for transitioning to a new thing.
Shana, you suggested that I tape record our steer. We have a steer here at the studio, but
a real one, not a stuffed one. He is a real bull. It is out in the barn. What's his name?
His name is Patty.
That's right, Patty.
He doesn't talk much, so I couldn't record.
As in hamburger, so. Patty? You sick boy.
No. It's not supposed to be hamburger Patty because our daughter said she would run away if he ended up in the freezer.
And you've had him for how long?
10 years.
Yeah.
There's no male bovine that lasts 10 years in the world except here.
So, Chris, have you ever had like one of those ideas that just keeps coming into view? You know, you turn around, there it is again. Just an idea that the universe seems to be poking at you and poking at you and poking at you.
Yes. I know what this is. Yes.
So the idea that's been working on me lately has to do with the impact of or lives that people perceive to be empty and meaningless on our world, on our culture, on our shared common life together. And it wasn't an idea that I knew much about or had thought much about beforehand, but it started coming at me first in an article about the Oath Keepers and then in an article about Marjorie Taylor Greene, and then in both of those articles, they referred to different writers and philosophers who had been looking at just this very social enigma, if you will, since the 20th century, you know, since the 1920s. Again, it surfaces in the 50s, comes up again, you know, in and around the 80s, and here we are in the first quarter of the 21st century, and we're still here talking about the you know, what happens when a people perceive their lives to be empty and meaningless, or arrive at a place where their lives actually are empty and meaningless. Last week, in a previous show, in our interview with Tim Peebles, towards the end of the interview, he referred to something similar when he was talking about how his younger self would probably view his current self as a bit of a heretic, I think, perhaps. But he said had he not had an awakening to the concerns of those at the margins, he would have been a Trumper. He would have been a QAnoner. So he has compassion and sympathy for people who got caught up in that whole movement. And he talked about the necessity to hold in tension our compassion and while still holding people accountable. And that, I thought, was a really great jumping off spot because you and I had talked about doing this series in which we explored the impact of boredom, directionlessness? Is it a social phenomena? And if so, what is the impact that it's having currently on our lives? Can I just go and snag these couple of quotes from the Atlantic article on the Oath Keepers?
Yeah. Go ahead.
All right. For our listeners, the Atlantic magazine writer Tom Nichols did an article that appeared in December's edition. The title of the article is "Why Did the Oath Keepers Do It?" And he basically makes the point that these were people who were bored, who had no lives. He says, "I'm struck not by the grandiosity of the militias, but by their smallness. Rhodes is a disbarred lawyer who managed to shoot himself in the eye. Kelly Meggs, the leader of the state Oath Keeper chapter, was also found guilty of seditious conspiracy, was a Florida car dealer, a detail so perfectly cliched that Hollywood would never have dared script it." He goes on to say, "Despite being a man of certain generous girth myself, I will note that the cosplaying amateurs who seemed to adore these organizations were not exactly trim and fit soldiers, which is why they were often dubbed the Gravy Seals and Meal Team Six by internet wigs. And yet, for these small, unhappy men, we had to suffer the first failed peaceful transfer of power in American history. In the end, it was a rebellion about nothing. Or more precisely, it was a rebellion born in affluence and boredom and a desperate search for meaning in otherwise ordinary lives." I don't know. Maybe my compassion has its limits.
So I have a question for you as we unpack this a little bit further. Do you think that it's a part of human nature to desire meaning by transcending the self?
I do. I think it's a natural part of a healthy human being.
It's part of just getting beyond the prison of our own narrow individuality. We are, speaking of human nature, we're made for relationship, and it's in relationships that we can achieve a sense of self-transcendence. We get outside of ourselves. Yeah, so my question has a direction, and the direction is this, which is since you read the Tom Nichols, taking January 6th and the insurrection, but it could be a countless examples from history that we could point to. The people involved in that, I would imagine, I think it's fair to say, experienced a sense of self-transcendence by being part of a larger group. That's how mobs function. So from their point of view, they were finding a sense of meaning in solidarity with others for a cause that they thought was good, (emphasis) was based on a lie. My point is that we can point to the human desire, the human need for self-transcendence as a way to achieve meaning or feel meaning in life. But the observation, Shana, is it matters. Doesn't it matter? It matters. I mean, I guess I'm not going to ask it as a rhetorical question. I'll just state it matters what the transcendence is based on. In other words, the follow-on question or the next question then is, on what are we basing our self-transcendence?
Right. And that is
And that's evaluative. Like,
yes.
It's like, this is good, this is bad.
Right. Let me just jump into something that I think goes to that, which comes up in this article in which Tom Nichols is quoting Eric Hoffer's 1951 warning. Eric Hoffer, for those who don't know, was a really interesting social philosopher who emerged in the 1950s with a seminal work whose title is escaping me right now. He had been a longshoreman, and, you know, so he sort of kind of hit the philosophy seen it from a non-traditional path. Hoffer noted that the most dangerous people in society are not the poor and desperate, but the well-off and the bored. He writes, there's perhaps no more reliable indicator of a society's ripeness for a mass movement than the prevalence of unrelieved boredom. In almost all the descriptions of this periods preceding the rise of mass movements, there is reference to a vast ennui, and in their earliest stage, mass movements are more likely to find sympathizers among the bored than among the exploited and suppressed. So he says, to a deliberate fomenter of mass upheavals, the report that people are bored stiff should be at least as encouraging as that they are suffering from intolerable economic or political abuses. So the fact that, I mean, you've got these characters, you know, you've got like Trump and Giuliani, you've got Stuart Rhodes, you've got this other, you know, band of Looney Tunes who preyed on this. I mean, they clearly understood it. They knew they had a good, solid fascist ideology down. They knew that, you know, all we need to do now, we've got boredom. So that's one ingredient. Now we need to identify an enemy, everyone who's not us and who doesn't think like us. And boom, you know, give it a quick stir and we've got ourselves a hot stew. And they did. So yeah, it matters. Was it Emerson who said, make no mistake about it, you know, a man will worship something, right?
Right. So that quote you read took me to Hannah Arendt and her very similar analysis. And in addition to the ingredient of boredom, she adds the ingredient of loneliness of the modern world, the modern life. And modernity, as you, like your historical kind of excavation of this towards the beginning of our conversation. I mean, this, you know, I think when was Death of a Salesman as a play written,
right?
You know, Babbitt in the
1920s.
So when we, you know, talk about modernity, we're not talking about, you know, the 21st century. We're talking the last 50, 80, 100 years.
It keeps coming back to capitalism.
Well, and this is how you started, which is this, the idea that keeps coming back. But let me just tie this up with a little reflection on loneliness, because I think this, again, so when you have a society of atomized individuals, this is Arendt, they are ripe. Boredom is a piece of this, but that society is ripe for the authoritarian, the demagogue, precisely because because that atomization is so intolerable. There's such a desire for some kind of transcendent connection that it's almost easy picking.
We are genetically wired for connection. So when people get isolated and then somebody comes in and offers an opportunity for connection to break the boredom and break the isolation.
So follow me for a second here with this. It's tempting. You and I are religious professionals, right? It's tempting to sit here and say, well, all you lonely people, come out to church.
Oh, God.
Well, isn't it, though? Like, just find a good and healthy, okay, maybe not church, but find a good and healthy spiritual connection where you can practice self-transcendence in a healthy way.
I feel
but
like,
is it that easy? I think that's my question.
I hesitate because of what's going on in the church and because how much the church is in fact responsible for some of this. How much of this is a consequence of Christian nationalist, right-wing, racist agenda that has spewed hate and division for so long under the auspices of calling itself a church. So, I mean, yeah, no, I'm disinclined from just saying the answer is go to church because, you know, which church and what are they preaching? What does the spirit of Christ look like in a Christian church, or what ought it look like? How do you know? What's the litmus test? And if it's not a Christian church, I mean, you know, it feels to me like it's easy to say, you know, you walk into a church. Okay, here's the litmus test. I'm going to try it. And then I hope our listeners will chime in and tell me why I'm wrong. But my inclination is to say the litmus test is this church talking about how we shall get along with one another? Or is this church talking about who is in and who is out? A healthy church, a church that is imbued with the Holy Spirit of human connection and the divine and the Spirit of Christ and, early Jewish teachings, a true Islamic spirit, those churches are going to be talking about how we shall get along with one another. And if you walk into a church and it's all about who's in and who's out, get the hell out of there. So it's not as easy as just saying go to church. It's not as easy as just saying, turn to God, because we know some people who have done that so convincingly that they wound up out in a jungle with 400 adherents drinking lethal Kool-Aid. People have to be able to think for themselves. There's no easy out. And in order to think for yourself, the first thing you have to do is disengage from culture. You have to intentionally put yourself someplace for certain periods of time on a regular basis that enable you to disengage from culture in the same way that we would say, look, fish don't know from water. They're born in it. They swim in it. They live in it. They breed in it, spend their entire lives in it, but they have no idea what the hell water is or that it even exists. You want to enlighten the fish. You grab it by the tail. You lift it up out of the water. The minute the fish hits air, the fish knows water. In the same way, human beings have to be pulled out of this mindless tumble from one moment into the next, from this consumerist mentality that tells us, if I just have more, I'll be happier. Buy more. If I have more guns, if I have, a bigger truck, if I have whatever, that will all make me happier. It won't.
Another observation that I would make is when we get to this point in the conversation, it's easy for us, I think for us, certainly for me, to put the responsibility for responding to the meaninglessness and the isolation and the boredom, put the responsibility on the individual, each of us. And I wonder if we can shift the angle of vision. It's true, there is individual choice and individual responsibility about what I choose to do in the face of this modern society. That's true. And what about, and this is where I struggle for language, but I think there's also the possibility of looking at this from a communal. It's almost as though we accept the boredom, the modern life, the consumerism. We accept all of that and ask then, how is the individual to respond? And I think the additional question is, How do we shift the systems that give rise to this kind of crisis of meaninglessness? And that takes more than individuals choosing to respond in a certain way. That takes people coming together to think about, imagine, and take action for a different kind of way. And you've pointed to people, and there are people doing this. There are people doing this.
Yeah, and I think it's brilliant, and of course you're right that ultimately this is about the work of community, and there are individuals who are out there who are isolated and they're not going, they're not joining communities. They're choosing to remain isolated and alone. They're choosing to stick their heads into a very narrow tunnel of incoming information.
But also there's a large segment of people who are happy enough in the system as it is. They're doing just fine.
Yep.
And they are doing just fine. And that's good enough. But
it's complacency.
It's not good enough.
It's complacency.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's working well enough for you, so you're okay with turning a blind eye to what's happening around you. And this is what I was preaching on this weekend. Like, I get the news is hard. And we feel like we absolutely must shield ourselves from how hard it is. So we So we tune out and we go shopping and we do things to numb ourselves. But staying numb removes the impetus for us to be, as Martin Luther King said, maladjusted to the way things are. And we need people who are maladjusted to the way things are. But maladjusted and working within certain parameters of nonviolence and working towards community and bringing people together and understanding that, you know, this is a nation in which there are different points of view, and however we move together, the vehicle in which we move has to be big enough to hold those different points of view so that you can see when you enter a movement like, you know, the Oath Keepers or these militias that gathered on January 6th, that you have some criteria in your own head and your own heart where you can say something's wrong here. This is not what I ought to be involved in. And that is, so it is a both and. It is both the individual and the community. An introduction to our theme for the next month or so on. I did have a question I wanted to ask you, though, Chris, and we may or may not get into this for this show, but, you know, there's a theory out there or a philosophy out there that teaches that life is empty and meaningless. At its core, life is empty and meaningless, and that it is up to us in the context of our lives and the communities in which we live to create meaning and purpose. And I was just wondering what you thought about that, if you think that's true or...
I think there was a time in my life when I bought into that, but I don't believe that anymore. I am thinking of Macbeth, life is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. And I'll be the, you know, and then this is like Sartre's hero. I will heroically inject meaning into this meaningless void. That's not the story I would tell.
But I mean, human beings are meaning-making machines. We abhor a void.
That is so.
If there is a void in meaning, we will fill it, and oftentimes with some real nonsense. So
I certainly wouldn't deny the experience of meaninglessness and the experience of doubt as being authentic to a human life.
In some ways, I think the assumption that there is an already always existing meaning sets us up for, you know, for example, an omniscient and omnipotent God.
Yeah, right.
And if one believes that God is all-knowing and all-powerful, you look around on a day-to-day basis and you got to ask yourself, what the hell is wrong with this God, and why isn't he doing anything to stop this, or she doing anything to stop this or change this, or, you know, how does a loving God allow a 6-year-old kid to walk into his classroom and shoot his teacher? Like, where is the plan in that?
No, that's
fair.
Or a tree
to come down on a toddler, no. Or, you know, so there's a thing about, there's something just at the edge of my consciousness that I'm playing with. It's just like starting to kind of come into view a little bit that has to do with that meaning and purpose is always just at the edge of our awareness, where, according to my theology, God also dwells. So it's always a reach, and it's always something that is in process. It's happening now. And so it changes and it moves and it's flowing. One of my favorite artists, a guy by the name of Brian Andreas, draws these wonderful little figures, and then he writes these sometimes funny but sometimes very profound reflections. And one that I was using for the sermon last weekend had to do with this little creature in this little wagon with wheels and an umbrella, and the saying underneath is, you know, I spent a long time trying to find my center until one night I realized it had wheels and it moved quite easily in a breeze. And so now I spend a lot less time sitting and a whole lot more time sailing. So the meaning and the purpose, our centers, if you know, particularly for those who are humanists, our centers, our core beliefs, are something that are always moving and growing. But I think in order to be in a healthy place about that, one almost has to subscribe to something bigger than just me. Like that has to be, that's the alpha and the omega, is that it isn't just us. And even if it's just about human connection one to another and not about God, although I would say that human connection is God also, but, you know, if you're not a God person, but that's something bigger than us that compels us to try to figure out the answer to the question, how shall we live together? And do it well and honor all beings and this beautiful planet that was given to us.
I loved that, how you described that process now. It gave me chills. Like, I was like, yeah, there's something alive in that. That's really in contrast to us, I think, rightly critiqued account of meaning where it's just out there and we just need to read it. It exists objectively.
It's fixed.
It's
right.
That's deadening. And what you've outlined is something very live and lively.
Yeah. It's that process theology stuff, you know, that God meets us on the forming edge of our lives, has a preferred option for us, is constantly calling us forward. But as the world changes around us and as circumstances change around us, we are called to be flexible in that, to be able to discern what is happening and what is needed, and to have some core principles, which again, ain't going to come from culture, because the only thing that's going to come from our culture currently, at least the way I read it right now in America, is that everything will be just great if every kiss begins with K, if diamonds are forever, if whatever. You just have to buy more stuff. You just have to have the right deodorant or the perfect cologne, or the right stuff will get you there.
Yeah, that society is not long.
No, and I'm hearing the term used more and more often, end stage capitalism, and I think it more often than not describes frighteningly where we are right now. Stay curious, Chris.
Go deep, Shana.
And shine light. Thank you to our listeners who have spent another couple of minutes with us as we explore the reclamation of our public narrative. We are here in part courtesy of our generous sponsors who are giving to this show on Patreon. You can join that group of generous donors if you would. We would appreciate that by going to Patreon, patreon.com, and then going to What in God's Name. And we appreciate all of it.
You can sign up for our newsletter on our website, whatingods.com. You can also see lovely pictures of Shana, Brandon, our associate producer, and me. That is whatingods.com, Shana.
WHATINGODS.
Great to be with you.
It is always wonderful to be with you, Christopher.